Welcome to Mentors Collective. On this episode, I have a guest that you may have heard of before and on topics that you might be familiar with. We're going to be discussing the COVID pandemic, the vaccine, long haulers, and a lot of information that we may not have felt comfortable talking about 2-3 years from now. So I'm honored and blessed, and so are you, to be able to hear from and learn from our guest today, somebody that you may have already heard from in the past. But it's been a couple years, so I'm glad that we can shed some new light on this and have new conversations about this polarizing topic that divided all of America. So with that being said, I want to welcome you, Dr. Peter McCullough, and just do a little introduction for those who don't know you. Dr. McCullough is an accomplished cardiologist. He was the vice chief of internal medicine at Baylor University, a very prestigious university. He did an interview with Joe Rogan back in 2021 that broke headlines. It went absolutely viral. He discussed some COVID alternative treatments, some vaccine risks, things that were an absolute taboo to talk about at the time that no longer are. And he's now serving as the chief scientific officer at the wellness company. So Dr. McCullough, I just want to welcome you to the show. I'm excited to have this conversation with you. I'm not sure if you know too much about my background, but I come from a medical background as well. And this was a time that me and all my colleagues were terrified to talk about anything that went against the mainstream narrative. So Dr. McCullough, thank you for being brave. Thank you for coming to speak with me and share with our audience today. Welcome.
Thank you.
And I know you're a little short on the voice today, a little hoarse. So I appreciate you suffering through it and toughing it away with me today. But let me just start by saying, when I was I graduated medical school in 2019, I did a 1-year residency in family medicine. And got out right before all of this really went down. But during this time, I was talking with my colleagues in medicine. We're like, all right, this is new. It's the first thing that's ever happened in our lifetime. We don't know what to do. We're young. We're just starting. Our opinion doesn't really matter anyway. Our job is to kind of just carry the torch, spread the good word, and go about our business. And then the narrative started getting weirder and weirder. And they would say things that I knew intuitively and through my learning, like, didn't make sense, didn't align with my knowledge of immunity, the immune system, how that worked. So I can only imagine what that experience must have been like for someone like yourself, who is a total badass in medicine, who is a cardiologist, a vice chief at an established university. I know what that takes because I went through academia. But Dr. McCullough, for the audience who's listening and may have written that narrative off as a hoax, as misinformation, they don't know what you went through to become that accomplished of a physician. So can you share briefly what that journey was like, starting for maybe from college?
I think from the time I graduated high school to the time I was fully formed, that took 17 years. And it's a long training pathway. And so, I went to Baylor undergrad and then UT Southwestern in Dallas, finished top of my class. Trained at University of Washington in Seattle as a top medicine program, just ahead of the Harvard programs at the time. Did 3 years of rural service, and then went to graduate school at University of Michigan, one of the top schools of public health in the United States. Trained in cardiology at Oakland University William Beaumont School of Medicine. My first paper was published in the New England Journal of Medicine. I became very prominent in my field. The highest position I ever held was the chief academic scientific officer of a major health system.
Wow.
I was the chief of cardiology at the University of Missouri, Kansas City. So I had ascended the ranks. I met full professor of medicine at multiple medical schools. I was the editor of 2 major journals, the inaugural editor of the Journal of Cardiorenal Medicine. I had studied heart and kidney interactions. An average professor would have 25 peer-reviewed papers in PubMed, listed in PubMed. I mean, I'm coming up on 700 right now. So 2007, I testified in the Congressional Oversight Panel. I was on C-SPAN for 7 hours. I've lectured at the European Medicine Agencies, New York Academy of Sciences, FDA, all the major medical schools in the United States. They all know me. So when COVID-19 hit, my analysis was there's 2 bad outcomes, hospitalization and death. So we need to organize our efforts to prevent hospitalization and death. That's what I did. So, I treated all my, I did risk stratification, who's likely to be hospitalized or die. And then I devised treatment approaches. Like any doctor who's reasonable would do that.
Right.
But what we saw from our government agencies pretty quickly was to say, and actually it was memorialized in the guidelines from the NIH, October 8th, 2020. They said, listen, don't do anything to prevent hospitalization. Let it happen. Let as many people come to the hospital as possible. And then once they're hospitalized, still don't do anything until they need oxygen, then start the first medications.
It sounds ridiculous. It was the most
nihilistic, untenable set of guidelines I've ever seen in my life. You would never let an outcome like that happen. Never.
Right. And they were shooting all the alternatives down left and right. And you were, I mean, I was a recently graduated medical student. I didn't have the confidence to say I know better than they did, but you did. You had published all of those research papers. You had years and years of clinical experience and the confidence to implement your own protocols. Why do you think they would treat it like that? They would not let you take precautionary measures. Why do you think they were trying to fill the hospital beds, in your words?
I think they were. They were trying to fill the hospital beds. I'm glad you said that. You know, I was going to publish the McCullough Protocol in New England Journal of Medicine. I've published there a lot. Mm-hmm. But I saw things going bad. New England Journal of Medicine published a completely fraudulent fake paper on hydroxychloroquine. Lancet published a completely fake paper on hydroxychloroquine. Mm. New England Journal of Medicine published a completely fake paper on ACE inhibitors and SARS-CoV-2 infection. It's something was going wrong. So I published the McCullough Protocol in the American Journal of Medicine. It was widely cited, 6 letters to the editor. I answered them all. Became community standard of care. Association of American Physicians and Surgeons had a home treatment guide by October of 2020. So basically what I said is, listen, I'm taking over. This is what I'm going to do. When I testified in the U.S. Senate, November 19, 2020, I held up my protocol. I looked right at the Senate. I looked right at the camera. I said, listen, I'm not asking for permission to do this. I'm doing this. Now, other people doing other things, they have to defend what they've done. And as you have intimated, they don't have any ground to stand on. This idea of not treating people, like Joe Rogan says, well, what if somebody disagrees with you? I said, Joe, if they disagree with me, that means they're not going to treat high-risk patients. That's a disagreement. I mean, let's not quibble about certain drugs. No single drug was necessary nor sufficient. We used drugs in combination. It was an empiric approach. Turned out it worked. Paper by Gugliakos and colleagues by December 2020 summarized all the outcome studies. We had clear and convincing evidence that early multi-drug treatment was working. What we learned retrospectively, the most powerful thing we actually did was nasal sprays and gargles. Dilute iodine, colloidal silver, xylitol in the nasal cavity, and then Scope or Listerine with iodine or xylitol or peroxide in the throat. That was far and away the most effective thing we did. And 17 studies, 3 large randomized trials. It was overwhelming how important that was if started early. Everyone wanted to be hyper-focused on hydroxychloroquine or ivermectin. And it was just ridiculous what happened. And there were doctors who learned how to treat COVID, no hydroxy, no ivermectin. And I featured them on my podcast, Barrentos from El Salvador, Chetty from South Africa. Interesting, they used lab-based approaches. So they risk stratified based on labs, which I thought was creative. But they used other drugs. They used high-dose vitamin D, high-dose vitamin C, zinc, quercetin or turmeric, famotidine.
They used, hearing about a lot of these things being used and in the news and in the headlines. What was the reaction from the medical institution to your treatment protocols and to these other doctors' treatment protocols when you thought you had something that was working and you were using it? And what did they say? What did they come back to and make you do?
There was cheers when I testified in the U.S. Senate, November 19, 2020. Everyone was, elated that the news was brought that we could treat patients. And within a few months, I was called in a room and fired for no reason. And it became clear there was crushing censorship on early treatment. You know, U.S. Senate hearing was completely censored off of all the media. We had never seen this before. This is the happiest news America and the world should have received crushing censorship. What we saw is we saw a single-minded focus on the COVID-19 vaccine. And so it turned out that all treatments were suppressed. So right. The nasal sprays and gargles, the Federal Trade Commission, FDA sued all the companies so they couldn't advance of 2020 saying do not use hydroxychloroquine. And it was never revisited. There was the research was just starting. I'm recently on a paper with over 30,000 patients treated, a very high quality outcome study. And it's those who received hydroxychloroquine and azithromycin, they had the lowest mortality rate. Those who didn't get any had the highest mortality rate. And it's not selection bias. I mean, the bottom line is at that numbers, you want to be in the group that got hydroxy. Ivermectin right. had very good data, you know, on and on. All the randomized trials were too small, underpowered, too late. They didn't have a chance of showing a difference. So the randomized trials weren't reliable. What we needed is we needed clinical judgment. But it wasn't just nasal sprays, hydroxy, and ivermectin. We saw that colchicine, which was in one of the largest, best done randomized trials, that was censored. Aspirin, all the vitamins, you know, every study with vitamin D was positive. That was suppressed.
Yeah.
And then even monoclonal antibodies, which were always safe and effective, they were quickly taken off of the market one by one. So all hopes of early treatment were intentionally impeded by government agencies all over the world.
I think we all saw that and agree with that too, that they were kind of intentionally put to the side or killed, whether that be from Big Pharma or whatever the reason. We'll definitely get into that. But the end result, as we all kind of saw, was an all-time low in trust in the medical institution, an all-time low in trust in the mainstream media. So the public isn't stupid. I mean, we saw what happened, and now looking back at it, we can tell kind of where everything went wrong. But let me ask, you said you were brought in a room and fired. After this was all kind of going down, you had your protocols, people were trying to figure out the answers. You had spent all these years building up credibility, authority in the medical space, 600 papers, wow. Was this the breaking point where you were like, you know what, I have to say something. I have to stand up and share my perspective, go against the mainstream media, the medical institution that's clearly doing the wrong thing. What provoked you to go and do that and put your longstanding career at risk?
Well, I saw the same thing you saw. I saw people being denied early treatment. A paper by Verdkirk and Lindley showed that it was those who were denied early treatment who were being hospitalized and died. They were dying because they weren't treated at home. Hmm. Hospital couldn't save them. Ventilator mortality rates ventilators weren't saving them. And so it boiled down to I could not stand on the sidelines and watch patients get slaughtered. I couldn't let my patients get slaughtered, my friends and family. I wasn't going to do it. And so, you know, I held to my Hippocratic oath to preserve life and above all, do no harm. The question is, why did other doctors step aside and let the virus slaughter their patients? You know, every patient who died made desperate calls to doctors. They all did. Yes. And the doctors turned them down.
Well, doctors, I mean, I can imagine, are reasonably scared, right? You've 17 years of investment of your time and money and into yourself as a doctor are all at risk if you go against the recommendations, the mainstream narrative, especially when you're all owned and controlled by a mainstream medical institution. They own you. So it can be terrifying for most doctors. And a lot of the doctors I spoke to at the time, it was a scary time for a lot of people. And you were brave enough to do something about it. Like, why do you think you were brave enough and other doctors weren't?
You know, there's no checkbox for bravery. And, you know, I don't consider myself a terribly brave person. You know, I don't shoot guns or skydive or do anything that you consider brave. I'm just kind of an average doctor. But I can tell you one thing is that I do have intellectual courage, meaning that even in my research early on with heart and kidney disease, that was a whole brand new area. I had proposed that kidney function does influence heart function like a risk factor. Everyone rejected that. I was in the back rooms at the American College of Cardiology. In the end, I prevailed. I was right on the cardiorenal hypothesis, and I knew I was right on the principles of treating COVID-19 early to reduce hospitalizations and death. And maybe it's just kind of one of these things when you kind of go down and you know you're right.
Right.
You know, are you going to stick to your guns all the way? And when you're right and you know you're right and people's lives are on the line, there's just no way I could back down. So, you know, I changed jobs. I got another practice group job in the same medical center. I did that for 2 years. Then I was fired from that job. Now I'm in practice about 30 miles away. I'm overloaded with patients. I'm helping them every day. So listen, job change is part of being a doctor. It's not a big deal. I got broad shoulders. I can take it. It's not about me. It's about patients. It's about Americans and people all over the world who suffered needlessly. In fact, they suffered from the narrative. It was fear. It was physical suffering, hospitalization, and death. And it all could be avoided. The vast majority could be avoided. What happened in Washington and with our federal agencies, largely over Zoom and WebEx, they did it all by WebEx. They didn't even show up. Will go down in history as just an absolute tragedy. None of it needed to happen.
Yeah, I agree with you. I tend to agree with you. What was your life like? You're in like 2021, 2022, when you decided to do this, you went on Rogan, faced massive...
My medical license is intact. It's never been a problem. I have a perfect clinical track record. But the American Board of Internal Medicine did go after me. You know, I've taken the internal medicine boards 4 times, always passed it, get great scores, keep all my CME, my maintenance and certification. Passed the cardiology boards 3 times. Some of my research is actually on the cardiology boards. So the American Board of Internal Medicine in May of 2021 sent me a letter and said that I violated their misinformation policy. Well, it turns out that they correct that. That was May of 2022. Turns out that they started a COVID misinformation policy in September of 2021, but didn't define misinformation. It was vague, didn't have any learning modules, didn't say what could be said or what couldn't be said. Then they went back to March of 2021 to my Texas Senate testimony and picked out, you know, under oath, when I give prepared marks and questions and answers, they picked out statements that I made and said, well, that's misinformation. So think about that. I violated a policy that didn't exist at the time. They went ex post facto. They didn't provide what their viewpoint on it was. So if they accused me of being incorrect, they didn't tell me what they thought was correct. Then they held a closed door meeting with some panelists, none of whom were COVID experts, none of whom were experts at all in their field, none of whom had ever testified in the U.S. Senate or state Senate. And they concluded that I had violated the policy. So then in the fall of 2022, they send me a letter saying that now my cardiology boards and my internal medicine board certifications are going to be stripped. And again, I've got a perfect clinical track record, so they'd be taken away for non-clinical reasons.
Right.
And they said, well, you know, I have 10 days to appeal. So I have to get lawyers. I appeal. And now my case is in this indefinite appeal cycle. So I'm still board certified by the internal medicine and cardiology. And as more and more time comes out, you know, I'm proven correct on these points. And I'm publishing. I'm one of the most published people on COVID-19 in the world right now. So, you know, we can sit down and discuss papers, but, you know, misinformation doesn't exist. I've never written a manuscript of misinformation. I've never taken a test on this. It doesn't exist in medicine. It's a propaganda term.
Right.
It was heavily utilized in Nazi Germany by Goebbels. It's propaganda. There's simply scientific findings, study results, data, and then we interpret it. We discuss it. This American Board of Internal Medicine doesn't hold the truth, some nebulous truth, and everybody else, you know, doesn't. They don't have
the things that was.
I had read very carefully. In fact, I contributed the introduction to a book, still to this day, the most comprehensive book and the first book to come out on this by Peter Bregan. It's called COVID-19 and the Global Predators. We Are the Prey. Most important part of the Bregan book is the timeline in the back of the book. And it goes back to 2012 or earlier. In fact, you should probably go back to the PrEP Act in 2005. The PrEP Act, written by HHS and Congress, said in 2005, there will be pandemics. And when they come, they will be national security emergencies, and we will have emergency countermeasures like vaccines. That's in 2005. That's in the National Archives. That's the PrEP Act. Then you go forward, 2012, DARPA, the military, announces a initiative. It's called the ADEPT P3 program. They said, we will end pandemics within 30 days using messenger RNA vaccines in 2012. It's still on their website. And what Bragan characterizes is 36 pandemic preparedness planning events. 25 have written documents, like two that I've cited. And then six are filmed, like Event 201 in the fall of 2019. So there's no doubt about it. There was tremendous pandemic preparedness, and there was clear anticipation that we were going to have a coronavirus. It wasn't any specific, but it was a coronavirus. So there was clear anticipation of this. So it wasn't controversial that I said it. It was, these are all historical features of it. Now, I said this, I went on Rogan in December of 2021, and Rogan's very late to the party. Believe me, at that point in time, think about that. I had already testified in the Senate in November of 2020, more than a year earlier.
Right.
You know, I go on Tucker Carlson in May of 2021. And that's Tucker's breakout interview. Tucker had never crystallized what was going on. He went nuts. That actually sent Tucker on a 2-year journey to the end of his showtime at Fox. He's still getting paid by Fox. So Rogan's pretty late. I mean, I think the only reason why Rogan's interested is because he had COVID himself.
Right.
And he basically got the McCullough protocol or version of it.
Yeah, he did.
So he's pretty late. And I was busy. I told him, you know, I couldn't get on right away. And I go down there and he did seem relatively blown away. And then he certainly was blown away with the response. And, you know, we got, you know, multifold increased number of views from his podcast within a few days. It was going viral. He actually called me about it. I said, listen, I can't control it. It's going viral. And, you know, we heard about Neil Young and Spotify, Prince Harry. Everyone's going to try to pull out of Spotify. And then Jen Psaki and the White House and Biden. And
in the end,
I'm exonerated. So people said, well, Dr. McCullough, everything he said was right. And that Rogan was accused of being a racist from prior podcasts and was told to take some podcasts down. So it was clearly just reprisal against Rogan. And I told him, listen, don't take my word for it. I have on other people. He subsequently had on other people. But, you know, I stand unique because I'm the person who had seen and examined patients. I had published the most. I clearly had the most seniority of any doctor he's ever brought on the program. And I stand by what I said. I mean, it was literally 2 days later where the news came out from the CDC, the Omicron outbreak happened. And Omicron did break through natural and vaccine immunity. So it happened. And I was on national TV that night. Actually, I was asked by Laura Ingraham. I said, yeah, my view has changed now. You can get COVID more than once. In fact, most people have. So, I mean, that, you know, major inflection points. The difference between me and the other people you've seen is, A, I'm clinically seeing patients. B, yeah. I'm actively publishing. And C, you know, I have always cited the data. When I go on interviews, I cite first author and data. No one does that. I'm the only one who does it. And so that's the reason why people have me on. I've had, you know, hundreds, if not thousands of media appearances at this point. People have me on. And I've always said, listen, you know, if there's any questions, let's pull the paper that I cited and we'll look at it together. There's no misinformation here. There's simply scientific citations and then a reasonable discussion. All of the major government major tenets of pandemic response were wrong. So masking as a primary public health measure, wrong. We should only wear masks when we go in the ICU. Next time, no public masking, just standard respiratory isolation procedures. You know, hand sanitizer, fine to do it, but we can't expect that that's going to handle the pandemic. It's fine to do it, but wrong. We should never quarantine people who are well. they're well for a reason. They should go out and be well. We should only quarantine the sick. We should always have an empiric early treatment approach for high-risk patients, and we should always employ risk stratification. We don't need to treat everybody, but we should quickly identify and protect the sick and apply early treatment. Vaccines are not treatment. Masks are not treatment. Hand sanitizer is not treatment. People have to understand we have to treat sick people to save lives. We cannot rely on vaccines. I'm not against vaccines. I was a principal investigator of a COVID vaccine program that the FDA and Operation Warp Speed didn't fund. But, you know, listen, I was all for vaccines, but in the program I proposed for nursing home patients and workers, that's it. You know, we should never have to vaccinate the whole country down to 6 months old to try to handle a pandemic. It would only be high-risk patients. The next pandemic's probably going to be a respiratory virus, and it's probably going to be very similar to COVID. And we know Bill Gates is predicting that, Tedros, Fauci, Peter Hotez. And the reason why I say that is there are so many bio labs out there that are working and doing gain-of-function research, making more dangerous viruses. Peter Daszak at the EcoHealth Alliance has a major library of these. He's working now with Duke University in Singapore. And so I wouldn't be surprised if something happens and we hear about a very serious virus coming out of Singapore, we'd know right where to look. Peter Daszak was working with Ralph Baric in the Chinese, Dr. Xingling Li in Wuhan, and that's where it came out. So yeah, we'll have another respiratory illness. And so we should rely on early treatment. The nasal sprays and washes perform beautifully, and they'll probably work against a future infectious viruses. And then we should never again have the government try to tell doctors how to treat patients. In the future, the government ought to be just trying to put people together, learn best practices. The next pandemic, we should have a Harvard protocol and a Duke protocol. Every great institution ought to be asked to use their innovation, use their creativity, and find solutions. Don't sit back and wait for the government to give them answers, because it obviously failed this time. It's been a disaster. And please, let's not wait to be saved by a vaccine. That was a total disaster for COVID-19. You know, in brief, we're to the point now where the Association of American Physicians and Surgeons, the World Council for Health, I've made the call in the U.S. Senate, the European Parliament. There'll be a testimony in a few days in the U.K. Parliament, all calling for the COVID-19 vaccines and boosters to be removed from the market because of safety issues. Excess risk of death, serious debilitating syndromes, neurologic, cardiovascular, thrombotic, immunologic, potential cancer risk. The COVID-19 vaccines are not safe for human use. Now we have evidence that maybe messenger RNA vaccines overall are a very bad idea. A paper by Crossan and colleagues show the messenger RNA targets the heart and is physically in the human heart. And if it's taken up by the human heart for COVID, it's going to be taken up for flu or Epstein-Barr virus or elsewise. And now we heard Moderna trial was stopped, messenger RNA vaccine for Epstein-Barr for cardiac toxicity. So messenger RNA, despite the country's love affair with messenger RNA and the massive government investment, it looks very dangerous as a vaccine technology. It may be fine for a future protein replacement technology if it's coding for a normal protein. I'm not against messenger RNA research overall, but for vaccines, it's got to stop. Well, go to twc.health and check out the wellness company. We just got word today that we have another major paper published in the peer-reviewed journal Curious, and it's going to be on the clinical rationale for base spike protein detoxification. This has been the single greatest breakthrough for people who took the vaccines, multiple rounds of COVID. There are three natural substances, probably a lot more, but three for sure we know have a beneficial effect. Nattokinase, bromelain, and curcumin, and then wellness companies combine them as a trio. It's called base spike detoxification. Huge, huge advance. Virtually everybody who's taken the vaccines had COVID multiple times, struggling with symptoms. It's a base. Now we use additional drugs on top of it, but wellness companies got doctors on telemedicine, know how to do this. They provide the products themselves. They've got health education. And importantly, now they even have a home treatment kit. that you can get. It's the first time that people can actually control their own destiny and have a little formulary of antibiotics, other drugs needed to get through an illness. Now, you do it through a gut doctor's visit and make sure what people understand what they're doing. But the wellness company is empowering people to handle minor issues like a UTI, a food poisoning, salmonella enterocolitis, something like this easily. And certainly, you know, people are not going to sit back and get slaughtered by the next pandemic. I can tell you right now, wellness company is going to help people through it. They're an alternative healthcare system, very, very popular. There's a whole variety of programs. You can get just a monthly membership. There's One Wellness, which is wonderful for diabetics, people, you know, who need multiple doctor visits, checking blood sugar, blood pressure, et cetera, where it's a monthly fee for unlimited healthcare and supplements. So a lot of options there. A lot of people with health insurance get Wellness Company as like a little supplemental to make sure that they're fully covered.
Thank you.